Hi there, a warm welcome back to Red Eyes Creations Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren and this is Internet Talk Radio, broadcasted from the west coast of Sweden. Nice to have you along. Thank you for tuning in. We are here on Thursdays and Sundays. You can listen to our program through our website, redicecreations.com. That's R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com, where we also feature news, articles, links, videos, and much more. So do take a look. Today we have Daniel Tatman back on the program to continue our miniseries on his upcoming book titled The Bath Mysteries. And last time we talked with Daniel, we talked about some of his background. We dived into masonry, secret societies, Masonic cornerstone markings, and we also discussed some of the architecture of Bath and different architectural styles. Fascinating program, and I encourage you to go back into our archive and tune into those first two segments with Daniel to get the full background on where we're going here today. So we're going to discuss the origins and foundings of Bath today. We're also going to discuss some of the myths connecting with the Welsh, Celtic and Druidic stories, some of the Saxon legends, the Arthurian cycle and much more. So settle in and brace yourself for another excellent program here with Daniel. I also want to mention his blog, by the way. He recently got it up there and new material is being added all the time. So do take a look at that. You can find it by simply going to www.thebathmysteries.blogspot.com. That's thebathmysteries.blogspot.com. So with that, let's say welcome to our guest. Hi, Daniel. Great to have you back on the program. Thank you for coming on.
Hey, Henrik. Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure to come back and continue the series.
Brilliant. Everything fine with you today? We're at the cusp, as it were, of the summer solstice, and it's nice to get into some, some Druidic, Celtic, and Welsh material here today.
Absolutely, yeah. It's very much, it's firmly put in the minds of people, I'd say, that the two things are very connected. You know, when you're thinking about solar and lunar festivals, a lot of the time your mind does drift back to Britain.
Beautiful. And are you doing anything special for the summer solstice? I mean, here in Sweden, we have the classic midsummer's kind of a celebration going on. That's the night before the actual summer solstice. Do you have any plans, Daniel?
I think if I can get a lift off one of my friends, I'll probably go to Avebury.
Cool, really?
But, I might not do that and just end up going to the High Point in Bath, which is a very nice big round hill, which I can look out over the whole city and even look as far as about 25, 35 miles away. So it's a great spot.
And I guess Bath is fairly small in that sense. You can get an overview of the entire city if you go up there?
Yeah, there's about two or three points where you can do that. And they're great spots, obviously, for any of the solar or lunar or other sort of stellar festivals that go on.
Beautiful. So it's a timely program as we're doing it here today. So, I think we should dive into here at the beginning some of the origins of Bath. I mean, there's very much information in regards to the mythology, the background, some of the characters who have been involved in founding of Bath and so forth. But I mean, if you were to put a date on this, Daniel, have someone out there made an educated guess about this? Do we know how old Bath is at this point?
Well, from an archaeological standpoint, I mean, they found there's a Celtic settlement which is known as Little Salisbury, after Salisbury Hill near Glastonbury. So this little hill is known as what they call a Celtic hill fort. And so it was an ancient Celtic settlement. And they've found different hunting materials and other signs that there were people living there from about 1000 to 1500 BC. But very recently, just in the last year and a half, they've been building a new bus station and a big shopping centre in the centre of the city. And when they were actually digging for the foundations, they found Celtic remains, which they dated between 6,000 to 8,000 years ago. So, I mean, because of this huge shopping centre which they're building, I mean, that's not exactly the best way to start a new venture, you know, to bring it to people's minds that they're building this new corporate facility on top of an ancient Celtic site. So
yeah.
it, out about it. But I think when I do get some good confirmation back from the local papers, I'll put something up on the blog about it.
Mm, very good. But to this day, then, we can say about between 6,000 and 8,000 years old, that's the guess?
Yeah, I mean, from the archaeological point, yeah, I'd say that from the actual evidence that we can see, you could put it anywhere from 2 to 8,000 BC.
Mm.
But that's just based on evidence. I mean, that doesn't actually take into account the logic of, obviously, people have lived here for thousands and thousands of years.
Right.
And there's been remains in other parts of England and Wales, and, you know, very close to here, which go back, you know, into what they call the Mesolithic area.
Yeah.
Era, sorry.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you know, we know that there's been people here a lot longer than that. And so, logically, you know, the place had a huge natural spring with water being pumped out of the ground, you know, so any of these places would always be absolutely fundamental. You know, they would be key. You'd have to get clean water.
Yeah.
You could use it for yourself, for drinking, for washing, for metal smithing, for different types of building, agriculture, you know. So any point anywhere in the world which you would find a natural spring, especially a large one, you'll have a settlement there right from the beginning.
Hmm.
So logically it doesn't stand up that would be the founding time.
Mm.
The settlement here, but that's what we see from the evidence.
Right, exactly. So it's probably as soon as people were either migrating up there or if they came from another part, probably they settled there as soon as they spotted the place, I guess, you know, mm. because of the resource.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Well, we see that anyway through the later history. Every group that kind of conquers England, the south of England, what we now know as England, always came to Bath and took over the place, and because you know there was baths for bathing in, and there was water to be drunk, and it was a real hot spot of activity mm. throughout the ages.
Yeah.
So yeah, we can see it. There's a lot of evidence for this just in mainstream history.
So if we're talking about the origins of Bath in relationship to the I don't know if we should call it the mythology of Bath. I mean, I guess that there is a lot documentation on this and so forth. But what does that state, Daniel? How did Bath came into to you know existence to begin with?
Mm, sure. Yeah. While I was researching into Bath for the book, obviously, really going into this material, I kind of at first when I started looking into the origins of it, I came to this figure called Bladud, King Bladud, and he's written about by a Catholic archdeacon, a guy called Geoffrey of Monmouth, in a very early text, kind of 11th, 12th century text, called the Historia Regum Britanniae, which is the history of the kings of Britain. And so the actual only account that we have of this figure is from Monmouth. It's the earliest account.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is very late in the game. But Monmouth himself, he puts the dating of when Bladud founded the first settlement at Bath between 863 to 500 BC.
Mm.
So obviously that's a lot earlier than we can see from physical evidence.
Right.
And so this character, Bladud, a fascinating story behind him, a very beautiful kind of metaphorical story of transformation, you know, which seems to be written only by Geoffrey of Monmouth himself.
Mm-hmm.
We don't find any other historians before him talking about him.
Mm.
I mean, there's many other historians which are very well known. There's one who was very kind of big through Saxon early time and sort of into the late Saxon period, a guy called Bede. In later years, sort of about the turn of the 20th century, he was kind of given an honorary sainthood by the Catholic Church, but he wasn't made into a saint. They called him the Venerable Bede.
Hmm.
This was the title they gave him. And so he's one of the key historians that most people will read if they go through classic history, or they go to kind of upper class schools in England. They'll read volumes and volumes by this Saxon historian Bede.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously he's one of the key sources that's used, and he doesn't mention Bladud at all.
Hmm.
So
weird.
Even though we have this incredible story about this early king that founds the city, you can't actually find him anywhere else. Even though in Monmouth's version, he has three sons who are hugely important. And one of them is actually a guy called Gwyn, who in the Welsh mythology is known as the king of the fairies, or the king of the fair folk. And he seems to sort of be the underworld figure. So, I mean, you have this very important figure of Welsh mythology, and his father being a guy who is only spoken about by one, again, Benedictine Catholic
friar,
you know. So, you know, he was a guy who, he'd come from Brittany and moved to Monmouth. He spoke Breton, Latin, and Welsh. And so he got hold of manuscripts from a friend of his called Walter, the Archdeacon of Oxford. And the material actually was apparently a kind of collection of some of the older Welsh tales. And from this, Monmouth said that he translated this history of the kings of Britain. Because for anybody that does have much knowledge on the Druids and the whole Druidic system, the bards would be the people that would remember family lineages and also the lineages of kings.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time this was oral tradition, and it wasn't to be written down. And so we have these later versions which were picked up by the Catholics and the early Christian church, but they seem to be very much lacking in their essence of what we know about Druidic culture. So, yeah, you have this fascinating character who seems to create this bladdered figure out of nothing, but also with these very strange connections with his family and with his son. And so the story of Bladdered is a fascinating one. He's supposedly a Welsh prince who, late in his education, he's training in a kind of druidic fashion. He is sent to Athens. And while he's in Athens, he's training with the various philosophers and teachers and astrologers there. And he actually becomes ill. He's stricken ill, and four of his close philosopher friends actually take him to a place up in the Athenian hills. And he comes upon a fountain, and he drinks from this fountain, and he's momentarily cured. So then he returns with these mysterious four figures back to Britain, and founds a few different colleges of learning on his way back.
Mm-hmm.
But when he arrives back at his actual kingdom, where he's come from, one of the druids of the High Court notices that he's actually got a kind of a strange mark on his face. And they inspect it, and they tell him that he has leprosy. And so he's banished from the kingdom as an exile.
Hmm.
And so, I mean, very, very intricate story, which carries on through the kind of the romantic historians that came after Geoffrey of Monmouth. They kind of embellished this story. And so that the kind of the full narrative I'm giving you is kind of the embellished full story, and kind of almost the accepted founding of Bath story that you'll hear if you go to any of the museums, or if you go to any of the heritage centres in Bath, they'll talk about Bladders.
Mm.
That is the founding of Bath as far as the city is concerned.
Hmm. And, I mean, do you think that the story is a fabrication, or is there more evidence that points to that this was a real man who lived?
The evidence, when you actually go into where Geoffrey got these accounts from, he spoke Welsh, and he said that he took them from Welsh manuscripts. You actually find that there's other characters that fit the same attributes that Bladud had very, very well. But also there's other characters within Geoffrey of Monmouth's text which also have almost exactly the same attributes, have the similar name, fathers, and sons and wives, and so in a sense you could say it was a fabrication, but also you could say that it was kind of an artistic rendering
mm-hmm. Yeah.
to be kind. So very much he was taking core elements from older mythology and trying to integrate them into this kind of narrative which he'd kind of made up to a large part. I mean, the majority of these kings which he mentions, you know, there's hundreds of them, the majority of them have never been found, and there's no trace to any other king. So obviously either he was a fantastically good writer, or in the future we'll find out that there's more to maybe some of the other kings that he was talking about than we at first thought.
Right, right. So,
but sorry.
I know, I just wanted to say that, you know, if we talked about Bladud there again, he was, as a consequence, because of his leprosy, then he was thrown out of the kingdom or a specific city.
Yeah, he was, as I said, he was a Welsh prince, so he came back to this Welsh kingdom, which kind of was meant to be in the sort of the centre of Wales. On the high beacons there, known as the Brecon Beacons and Black Mountains. So yeah, he was put into exile, and as was custom in older times, if you were somebody of authority or wealth or status, and you were sent into exile, they would often give you a flock of animals to take with you, because you could use them for trading, and you could eat them, and you could also have company. So it, you know, it would give you maybe a year or two in your life, you know, walking around with these animals. So, yeah, that's what happened with Bladud. He was sent into exile with this group of pigs. So he walks down out of Wales, sort of comes over the border of the now border of England and Wales, and he's walking down the Cotswolds, which is the hills which kind of would lead on from the Black Mountains. And he comes down and, as he's coming over one of the hills, sees this valley absolutely full with steam, all rising up out of it, you know, very much kind of a fairy tale kind of image, all of this incredible hot water and bubbling out of the ground and steam just engulfing this whole valley. The tale goes that, you know, he'd been walking for a long time, and so he thought he'd go to, you know, be refreshed by the spring. So he goes down, and his pigs that he's got with him, kind of, they've had actually supposedly contracted the leprosy from him whilst they were with him. So it's, we know that that's not actually possible today, but the myth
right.
was a part of it.
Yeah.
And so these pigs roll in the mud in this kind of little valley basin, and the next day he notices that they've been cured of the leprosy. So he goes back to the same place, back to this steam-engulfed valley, and rolls around in the mud and kind of bathes in the waters, and actually cures himself. So at that point he goes back to Wales and claims his kingdom, and, you know, in kind of memory and thanks of being healed, he builds the first settlement in Bath. Which they call Caer Badon, which means the meadows of bathing. So that's kind of the whole story of Bladud that we get from Monmouth and about 12 other authors that have built on Monmouth's tale over the years. And as I said, this is very much the accepted founding of the city. People kind of don't really want to delve any further because they think that this Bladud character is, you know, that's old enough. You know, you don't need to go back any further than that. Yeah, I was just going to say, what I found was, when I was speaking to some of the curators of the museums, of the Roman Bath, and some of these other places, is when you do talk about this figure, that they like to romanticise him, but they don't really want to go into any of the details about him, because he was a character which, it seems, was created by this Romanised Catholic historian, who very much kind of emulates the whole idea of the early Christian church, was that all of the civilization, all of the wealth, all of the intelligence, the administration and agriculture, all of this came from the East. And so we have this in the tale, obviously, this Welsh prince goes to Athens. You know, he doesn't go to Ireland or Bangor in North Wales, where we know that there was a Druidic college. He goes to Athens, apparently. But again, yeah, the locals in the area and all of the kind of the specialists on this subject, or the Bathonians, the people that really are into the whole history of Bath, they very much like to cling to this image because he kind of idealizes this almost Saxonized Christian pagan king. And there's not really very much Druidic material that's discernible. And it seems like he took his ideologies and philosophies from Greece anyway, you know, so he's very much a Hellenized kind of figure. And so, yeah, there's actually a festival going on at the moment, and a big kind of event all around Bath is, if you walk around it, you'll see these big metal pigs everywhere. And they're meant to be blooded pigs and the whole thing, you know, and hundreds of these things. And so, yeah, it's very funny for me, right at the point when I'm talking about this, they've actually got a celebration of blooded and his pigs,
right,
metal pigs all around the city. But this really emphasizes the point that they really want to cling to this, even though they know, as I said at the beginning, that the archaeological remains that have been found, you know, push it way back, you know, to sort of 6,000-8,000 BC, at least.
That's interesting. So, I mean, the image here might be a composite in a way, you know, different kings or characters throughout history, or even when you know, some people rediscovered the site or even took over it, they might have wanted to create a new kind of a deity, if you will, around this that people can think back to in regards to the founding of the city. But I mean, there's a few interesting things, like some of the sketches of Bladud. He's depicted with wings, for instance. That's pretty interesting, right?
Yeah, that comes from some of the later kind of Middle Ages and Victorian historians. Kind of they transmuted the story in later times to, you know, that Bladud was a man of magic who came to the area and created the springs magically with his powers of sorcery, you know.
Yeah.
And then they later say that he built himself wings so that he could fly, and that he actually threw himself off the top of a temple and died. But yeah, this was very much the latest transmutation. So they're connecting him with kind of this alchemical Solomon figure.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah.
But yeah, this was the latest transmutation of the story, the last kind of 400 years of it. But yeah, that's the picture that they leave you with. You know, obviously it's on Wikipedia.
Of course, yeah.
And if you do search on Bladud, you'll find this image. And yeah, he's standing very much in a kind of alchemical circle, or a sort of Goetian circle or something. You know?
Yeah.
There's nothing Celtic going on there, I can say.
So do you think that all the Celtic and Druidic connections to the site and so forth have been suppressed, written out of history, as it were, and they don't want to recognize the more ancient connection here?
Yeah, I think that's precisely what it is. I mean, this is a theme all over Britain, even though lots of documentaries and lots of material is coming out about the Celts. The historians, the actual guys that are doing all of the research and a lot of time making the new documentaries for Horizon and all these kind of BBC and National Geographic things, they very much come at it from the same point. They want to degrade the image of these people or put them over as illiterate people, you know, who needed somebody else to tell them what to do. But yeah, I mean, so it's a theme that we see all over Britain and also all around the rest of the world.
Of course.
Absolutely everywhere that's been colonized
has
that same motif. And so you have the modern scholars through the educational committees and all these kind of things. Yeah, just keep that story going through. You know, wherever you are, you'll find that same thing. And so it's not surprising at all to find it here.
So what can we say more about the wealth and even Irish Celtic Druidic connection to the site? Is there much more information here about this?
Oh yeah, there really is. There was a Welsh linguist, a guy called Owain Tanwyn, And he quite rightly understood that as Geoffrey of Monmouth lived on the border of Wales and spoke Welsh and took the translation from Welsh tales, that Bladud is actually a Welsh name, and so it should be pronounced in a Welsh fashion. And when you do pronounce it, it actually becomes Beloved. So it's kind of a B apostrophe before the rest of the word. And the B, it kind of be in Welsh the word for near and young, or old and far, are almost exactly the same. So the B apostrophe Loved would actually be the young Ludded, or young Lud, or near Lud.
Ah, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So this was the one of the first primary crossovers where I could see that there was another king that Geoffrey of Monmouth spoke of between sort of 400 to 800 years later, who was called King Lud. And this character seems to have had huge fame all over Britain. I mean, we can find 68 different places around Britain with Lud at the beginning. But all in all, because there's lots of repetition of names, there's about 300, 400 different towns with Lud at the beginning. So, you know, you can see that whether it was something to do with this king Lud, or whether there was something much older to do with this word that had a lot of meaning throughout Britain, you can't really say, but... It's kind of one interesting connection which I found kind of gave context and background for this king, Lud, because this is the actual account that we have of it, is that he and his brothers are actually kind of knocking back an invading force from Britain and have retaken the crown. And so this king and his brothers are going all over the British Isles and taking it back for kind of the Britons.
And Lud. So, yeah, no, I just wanted to say Lud, of course, also is the. I mean, that's the another sun king, basically, isn't it, Lud?
Yeah. Well, that's kind of the last mutation of it. I mean, through these word roots, you can track Lud to a Welsh character called Llyf, which is, you know, it looks exactly the same in a written form, but there's two L's at the beginning and two D's at the end. So it's the same character, and a lot of historians and linguists and others have all very much focused on this and seen that they were the same character. They have the same attributes, and they have the same kind of upbringing and the same sons. And so if you take it back even further, you know, again, you know, what you're quite rightly referencing, you know, which nobody else seems to have picked up on, which is strange, is that Llyf is actually taken from a much older Irish source. As you say, he's the sun god, or what's known or remembered as kind of the sun god figure, Lu.
Of course, yeah.
And the connection is made even stronger by the fact that Llyf is known in Wales as Llyf Llaw Eraind, which means Llyf of the Silver Hand. And for people that do know any of the kind of the mythology of Ireland, especially the people that to Arthur de Danann, they had a chief high king who was known as the Silver Hand. And after the death of this king, you have the character of Lu becomes the new high king. He actually becomes the Dug Da, as it's called.
Yeah.
Kind of the good god, or the good father. And so, yeah, you have Llyf of the Silver Hand, obviously is a later version, Welsh version, of this cognate version between Nuada, the original king of the Gaels, or the Tuatha, and then the new king, who, after the death of the High King, then becomes the overall ruler of the Tuatha, and this is Lu. So Caesar, son of Apollo, then you would have, if you had a very important king who had a particular name and somebody came into the throne after him, he would have a remnant of that name. So this was also one of the other names for Lu, was Lu of the Silver Hand. So you have bladders, blood, cleave, and Lu. And they all very much are the same character. They're all mirroring each other.
Yeah.
I mean, the Welsh legends themselves, historians would say that the oldest ones that we have come from sort of 600 to about 900 AD. But they do admit that these are from much more ancient origins, and they do come from thousands of years ago. And so you have this fascinating aspect. I mean, just looking into this one city, you know, I don't really want to go into a whole subject of the Welsh and the Celts, but just in trying to find out the origins of this city and actually going past what the official line was and actually looking into all the source material myself, I was able to pick out that the founding of the city, much different than 863 to 500 BC, could be anything from 4,000 to 8,000 BC.
Yeah.
And the kind of the icing on the cake to show the kind of the overall intent of Geoffrey of Monmouth, I feel, is when you take his version, which is blooded, a king or a prince with leprosy, and a group of pigs with leprosy, then you have the Welsh version, you'd have Cleve, this Welsh warrior king, and his high court with his druids and his builders, his farmers, you know, all of his ovates and druids and bards, you know, a whole huge group of the most important people. And then if we go back even further, we'd find Lu and, you know, the Tuatha De Danann themselves, the high magi of ancient Ireland.
Yeah.
And so you have this absolutely vast crossover between all of these different British mythologies. And when you get to the oldest version, which is Lu, which people have speculated could be anything from kind of 8,000, again, or 6,000 to maybe 2 or 3,000 BC, it starts to make sense when we lay that up against the archaeological record. And also in the Irish legends themselves, you have Lu when he becomes the king. You have the stories of when he goes to reclaim a certain harp and other stories. And they say that he's actually going to the Fomorian camps, the kind of the invading forces, and wiping them out. So, as I said earlier, you have all of these places which are known as Lud something. You have this mythology of this King Lud who recaptured Britain, you know, and was known as the Good King Lud. And then you have the Welsh version, who again did the same thing. His brother was called Llefelys, and apparently he was in charge of Gaul, France. And together they wiped all of these invading forces out of Britain. And then finally to the Irish one, to Bladud. You know, all of that has kind of been watered down. The High Court of Ireland, or the High Court of Wales, is nothing more than a bunch of pigs with leprosy.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's I felt that when you were, you know, going back into history, and then you realize that, wait a minute, this is almost like a ridicule story, and they put, you know, if he has a Catholic background, this, you know, this priest or clergyman here, then he might have put this kind of occult connotation on him to make this to get a negative spin on him.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, it keeps the origin of the story. I guess, you know, you could loosely say that what it's really about is the young tribulations of this guy, and the kind of the transformation of soul that he goes through. Because, I mean, you do have this in the Welsh and the Irish versions as well. The character of Cleve is meant to have grown at a kind of an unhuman speed and had very many kind of trials in his early life. which then give him this name when he's older, the new kind of this solar sleeve. And the same with Lou as well. You know, he's kind of built up through the mythology, and he's fathered and fostered by different family members. And so you have this, the same thing is actually told. And so, as you said, quite rightly said, you know, in some way it could seem as a mockery. And
yeah.
I do feel overall that it ends up being that. But in another way also, I mean, I was able to see it. So in a way it was veiled just enough so that if you had knowledge of the subject that you could actually pick out the truth. So in some ways I think perhaps he wasn't so much of a slanderous character. Perhaps he was more a product of his time. And was writing to please a few other archbishops,
right.
and bishops. And so there's kind of this real mixture of feelings I have towards the guy. But obviously, if it wasn't for him, I would have never even found out about these Welsh and Gaelic connections to the founding of this city.
Okay, so Geoffrey of Monmouth wasn't all bad then, I guess.
I guess you could say the same about anyone, couldn't you?
Sure, of course.
No one's all bad.
Oh, exactly.
And there's ways that you can learn from them.
Yeah.
And much in the way as you know, somebody who's aware, who's reading a book, can sometimes take higher meanings or larger insights than the original author intended.
Right. Well, and you raise a good point there, because that might have been the purpose of it as well. Because if the clergymen of the time wanted to still have the knowledge about the Druidic connection, but yet on an official level to those who were going to read that history later, that they definitely didn't want to recount the entire story, because as you said, they still wanted to draw this back to Greece or, you know, Athens, or that the knowledge comes from the East, you know, that's the main route here, you know.
Yeah, precisely.
So what do you think, Daniel? Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the archaeological record? You mentioned that you've been looking at some of this also, and that there is supporting proof then, I guess, that this might potentially, the city then, might potentially go back way much further. You mentioned, you know, around between 4,000 all the way back to 8,000 BC. Is there any kind of archaeological evidence for this, to this, at this point in time?
Yeah, as I said at the beginning of the talk, that there's kind of three sites in Bath which are known to have kind of very strong Celtic connections. There's one hill called Little Salisbury, which I mentioned at the beginning, and then there's also a place called Kelston Hill, Kelston Round Hill, which is another very big kind of earth mound with a big circle of oak and plane trees on top of it. And so it's very much the local historians know that these were both very important places for the Celts, and they found various Celtic remains, as I said, going back to 1500 to 2000 BC in both of these areas. But the oldest materials that have been found were these recent finds, which were right in the centre of the city, and which would have been a lot closer to where the springs actually would have been coming out of the ground. So, I mean, it would make a lot more sense that the Roman settlement was built slap bang on top of the Celtic settlement.
Yeah.
And that it carried on in successive generations like that. So there's not even that much remains of the Romans' buildings, you know, let alone anything Celtic.
Yeah. So that's...
Yeah, which is a shame, but I mean,
of course, all
these stones that come from the Celtic settlement were obviously used in the Roman settlement.
Yeah.
And the successive groups that came in, you know, it's a high likelihood that you've got a lot of Roman and Celtic stones in the actual houses in the city itself. This is something you'll find all around the world,
yeah,
absolutely everywhere, you know, that people will be kind of unawares that some of their houses are built out of a castle or something like that. You know?
Of course. How about this, you know, the Bath stone, I mean, is that similar to like the London stone, that this is another kind of Roman, you know, benchmark or whatever? What have you picked up about that?
The Bath stone?
Yeah.
Yeah, the one that is in the town hall, kind of the It's in the marketplace. Is this the one you're talking about?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you might not have dived into it, have you? Or let's see here.
There is actually a stone in the center of the marketplace.
Yeah,
which is known as the Bath Stone, which was used for bartering. And all of the main deals and everything would be done on top of this stone.
Yeah, okay.
Right on top of the center of the marketplace.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if that's the one that you're talking about.
I think that's the one. I picked it up on Wikipedia. Basically, sure. It has a thread on the Bath Stone, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's the stone. And so, yeah, it's very much connected to measurements and things like this because it's slap bang in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the actual marketplace is built in the shape of a huge octagon.
Ah, really?
So it's got some interesting kind of orientation values to it.
Mm.
Yeah, but I would say that, yeah, it would have connected back to what we talked about in the last section with the London Stone, so marking distances from that point.
Yeah.
Obviously, the town hall and the marketplace would be the centre.
Mm.
So that would be the best place to mark it from. So, yeah, I think that was probably the case.
Interesting. So let's see here. I mean, there is much more we can dive into. Of course, in regards to the wealth, you know, Welsh, I mean, background to all of this, is there more we can say about that? More about the Druidic connections or the Celtic connections?
They're known in the kind of the later years. So we're coming right up to the point of kind of the Romans. Kind of the turn of the millennium, you know, around the time of Jesus, and just after. And there's been quite a few authors recently. I mean, Lawrence Gardner has done a lot of material on kind of early Britain and the foundation of the first above-ground churches, which he's located at Glastonbury.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously it wasn't until the councils of Nicaea and Carthage that Rome actually took on board the Christian faith. So, you know, a lot of Christians were still getting thrown to the lions and tortured and killed. But Britain being on the other side of the world compared to the Romans, it seems as though the first above-ground church was actually set up in Glastonbury by a group that's now known as the Saul-Urians, or the Saul-Arians.
That's interesting.
Very interesting, obviously, the connections between the Celtic goddess, who was actually the goddess dedicated to Bath. She was called Sul, S-U-L.
Huh.
So it's the Arians of Sul, or the shining ones of the goddess Sul.
Huh.
So, yeah, very, very interesting connections in this whole area, going through into early Christianity, but also kind of in the way that some of the elemental Celtic ideas or concepts kind of stuck around in Wales and the West Country. So yeah, there's a lot there to talk about.
Interesting. Let's see here. So what do we want to dive into next here, Daniel? I mean, there's we can go into some of the etymology or some of the Saxon legends, or maybe that's too soon. What do you think?
There's so much material about kind of knowledge which has been picked up over the years about the Druids and the Celts. There's quite a bit more material that we can do in connection with Bath.
Yeah.
I mean, from the site which I talked about earlier, which is called Kelston Roundhill, I mentioned that I'd probably be going up there for the solstice.
Yeah.
And from there you can actually see an earthworks, which is about 2 miles away. It's actually kind of on a raised field, but it's on the side of a mountain or a hill, so you can see it. It's kind of like a picture from this hill, and it's of a snake almost kind of eating its own tail, but very much in the Celtic style. It doesn't look like the later kind of Saxon kind of snakes that they carved into the ground. But yeah, so fascinating sights all around from this point, which you could only actually see them from this hill. So this hill seems to have been a fundamental point of ritual, but also as well in connection with the surrounding hills. And so, yeah, there's so much fascinating material just surrounding these two or three Celtic sites that are left. And the other one, as I said, is Little Salisbury.
Tell us a little bit more about that, then.
Yeah, sure. Little Salisbury, it's surrounded, it's kind of in this organic, almost bean shape that kind of ascends slowly, but there's platforms. So it's very much, a lot of these historians talk about hill forts. But again, this is a big mistranslation because they take this from the word caer, which is a Welsh word. And caer actually comes from the root word of cae, which is just C-A-E.
Mm-hmm.
And it means meadow. And so most of these places, which they now call hill forts, so for example, and one which again connects back to Lu and the solar motif, there was a place called Caerleon on Usk.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, the meadows of the lion, or the fields of the lion. But also, it's now known as the Fort of the Lion.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, all of these sites are known as hill forts, and this is primarily because of the mistranslation of the word, but also whenever they find these kind of hilltop meadow settlements, they're surrounded by these ditches, and often they find ramparts and big wooden walls which were put up there.
Hmm.
But I always use the metaphor of if we had some tremendously huge war and archaeologists were to come back and look at some of our towns where all the people had disappeared, and they saw kind of these big concrete roadblocks that you see that the police and the army sometimes drag out, it would be the same as these guys saying, looking and saying, oh, well, this place is obviously a fort.
Hmm.
Because it's got ramparts and blockage, all of these different defences around it. But it wasn't the case. I mean, these were people which were living in the hills because they'd had great catastrophes with different effects which were bringing the water level up. There's lots of different ideas about why that happened.
Yeah.
But it's been shown by many different scientists in many different fields that even 3,000 years ago, the water was 300 meters lower. Going back in time, we can find that this was definitely on the minds of these Celtic peoples, and so they always settled in these high points. The main reason that the archaeologists would kind of think that these places were forts was because they had all of this wooden wall around it, but this was only because they were under attack from the Romans.
Hmm, of course.
It's very much like the parallel that I used for the city. I mean, they did set up ramparts, they did set up walls, but only to fortify the settlement, the area which they'd been living in.
Yeah.
But this is used as a real kind of blanket statement, to tar all the Celts, to make them into these chieftains and warlords.
Yeah.
Every settlement is a fort.
Well, I mean,
all these people do, apparently,
Well, exactly, and as you say, I mean, they were forced to become warlords, because if you're attacked, what are you going to do? Just, lay down and say, oh, no, it's all over. Of course, you have to defend yourself. And as you said, that's pretty interesting, too, that there might have been, going back further back, that this might have also been a reason for it being, earth changes overall or flooding occurring a lot of times. Could some of these have been acting like, I don't know, levees, what have you, to keep water out? Is that possible too?
I'm not so sure about that, but
yeah.
From the kind of the geomantic side of it, it's very interesting, the actual physics of having a ditch dug in the ground around something. Because it means that any kind of electromagnetic forms and waves which move through the earth very much like water, they will take the path of least resistance.
Right.
So when they hit this point in the ditch, they actually go down with the meander and actually go round in a circle and follow the ditch. So, and this is my contention, was that this was very much more to do with why they had the ditch there, was to do with the geomantic and energetic qualities, and how you could then make your settlement, you know, a very healing and place that was absolutely full of life, you know, on very many different levels, and all of the area just outside the settlement could be agriculture, and it was kind of emanating these waves of earth energy.
Yeah.
But yeah, obviously that whole image, that whole idea has been very much overdone by all of the modern archaeologists who just say they're all forts, you know. Say they dug the ditches to keep people out.
Exactly. Huh, that's pretty interesting. You know, we have tons more, Daniel, to dive into here in our next segment. Excuse me. We're going to talk more about some of the etymology, but also about some of the Saxon legends. We have a little bit about on the Templars to dive into, the Arthurian cycle, Merlin, and much more. But before we do that, you know, and things off here for this segment, I want to talk a little bit more about your book. I know that you're writing it right now, and of course, everyone can find more information on your website. But as we said last time on the show, for people that are interested in pre-ordering your book, you have a way to do that, isn't that right? Tell us about that.
Yeah, at the moment it's nothing very sophisticated. It's just a small button on the right-hand side of the blog, and you can click it and directly send me an email. So, I mean, the pre-order button is just to give you my email address. So anybody that is interested in pre-ordering the book and helping with the kind of the first batch or the first edition, then yeah, I would greatly appreciate you to give me an email and just let me know.
Beautiful. And tell us your blog website address again.
Yeah, it's www.thebathmystery.com.
Very good.
Blogspot.com.
Yeah, there we go. Exactly. Yeah. So one more time, it's the Bath Mystery and then an s.blogspot.com. That will get you to Dan's blog, and keep up with that, because again, he's adding new stuff all the time. You'll find things that we've been discussing here today, things that we discussed last time on the show, and things we haven't discussed. So definitely worth checking that out. But with that, I want to thank you very much for tuning in here for this first segment. Thanks to Fredrik behind the controls. We'll continue, as I said, talking more here with Daniel in a little bit after the break. We'll dive into more on etymology, the Welsh chronicles, Saxon legends, the Templar connections, Arthurian cycle, and much more. But with that, thank you very much, Daniel, for coming on. Stay with us, and we'll talk more after the break.
Great stuff. Thanks.